From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. A Visit to Claudia by Nora Loves. My friend Claudia Gaywood is a woman who, but for her good nature, would be intolerable. I remember her from our earlier school days when she was a pretty, pampered, rather self-conscious little darling whose possessions and privileges would have been the envy of all if she had not been so willing, indeed so anxious, to share them. 40 years did little to change her. She retained her looks, her health, and her capacity for facile enthusiasms. She was always adopting and quickly abandoning poses, theories, causes. She was one of those people who scan the more serious articles in Reader's Digest and are at once prepared to discuss the subject dealt with as though they had expert qualifications. Widowhood eclipsed her for a month or two, but she emerged seemingly unscathed, having, I basely suspected, concentrated upon the correct attitudes and conventions. As time went by, I met her less and less frequently, but she was a great letter writer, an indomitable remember of Christmases and birthdays, one of those people who on holiday spends much time buying highly colored picture postcards, scribbling, "Wish you were here," and dispatching them to their less fortunate friends. 2 years ago, she went to spend a weekend in East Anglia with some people named Crawley. She sent me a postcard from their village, the scrawled message admonishing me to note that the church had a Saxon tower. Soon after, I received one of her enthusiastic, slightly incoherent letters. The most exciting thing had happened. The Crawleys had taken her for a drive, and they had gone through the prettiest village with a charming name, Talbot St. Faith, and Claudia had just said, "Oh, I could live here," and hardly had she said this then. Wasn't it astounding? There was the house of her dreams, covered with wisteria, empty and for sale. Or so she'd bought it. There was a great deal of work to be done on it before it was habitable. If she didn't write for a while, I should understand. Write, however, she did. Copious letters in which the phrase, "I simply must tell you," featured frequently. A wall was found to be damp, and before it could be attended to, part of the wisteria had to be cut away. The cutting had revealed an old lead gutter spout, which bore the date 1720. The room, she had decided, was to be the drawing room, had the ugliest little fireplace, impossible to live with, so she'd ordered its removal, and behind it there was a wonderful cavernous brick hearth, for which she must now find a basket grate of the proper period. When it came to stripping off some hideous wallpaper, magenta roses on a yellow ground, my dear, the paper was found to be attached to canvas which had hidden some elegant 18th-century pine paneling. When it came to furnishing the place, I gathered that all the antique shops in the region had a boom summer. Since she was doing precisely what I, given the means, would dearly have loved to do, these letters would have provoked me to envy and malice, but for Claudia's touching desire to share. Before the house was finished, she invited me to go and rough it with her. Then, as work progressed, she told me that she was furnishing her guest room with me in mind, and that on the ground floor there was a darling, snug little room overlooking the garden, very quiet, just a place for me to work in. During her first spring in the house, she sent me a large, badly packed box of daffodils and forsythia with a message, "Since you won't come to Newell's, Newell's must come to you." She had called the house Newells after a former owner, about whom she said she would tell me when we met. It was too long a story to put into a letter. A number of circumstances prevented me from taking advantage of these warm invitations, and Claudia had owned Newells for more than 2 years when I found myself faced with temporary homelessness. It was then November, not everyone's choice for a month in the country, but I liked the contrast between miry ways and glowing firesides, and I liked the pattern of bare boughs against the sky. Also, I had heard a good deal about Claudia's central heating. So I wrote, and within an hour of receiving my letter, she was telephoning me. My visit was the one thing to which she and Newells had been looking forward. I arrived while there was still light enough to see by. The house had the flat front, the evenly spaced windows, the parapet, the wide fan-lighted door of the Georgian heyday. But behind the parapet, rearing against the November sky, was a clutter of chimneys, some twisted, some of molded brick. I thought with a pang of unworthy pleasure that I could tell Claudia that a date on a gutter spout was not infallible evidence of a house's age. And then there she was, pretty as ever, ebullient, warmly welcoming. She showed me where to put my car and insisted upon carrying in the heavier of my two suitcases. She said she was glad to see that I had brought my typewriter. She hoped I'd stay for months and months. I looked pale, she thought, and tired. Country life and air would do me a world of good. So would the atmosphere of Newells, so 18th century. I should soak it in and be inspired. Wouldn't it be thrilling if I settled here long enough to write a book? In the attractive hall, she deposited my case at the foot of the staircase, then opened a paneled door into a cloakroom. If you want to wash, she said, then we'll have tea right away and I'll show you your room later on. Her drawing room was beautiful. It was also warm and full of the pleasant earthy scent of chrysanthemums. The basket grate was heaped with logs, and the firelight flickered on well-polished surfaces, on china and silver. Claudia had, as I feared, made the 18th century her own. The silver tray and the tea service were Georgian, and she made the tea at table, ladling the tea from a genuine old caddy with a genuine old caddy spoon, and pouring water from a spirit kettle. We ate tiny savory sandwiches. They're made with gentleman's relish, she said. I'm not quite sure that it was known in Captain Newell's day, but I somehow feel that he would have approved of it. Some streak of perversity made it impossible for me to ask the obvious question. And who was Captain Newell? There was saffron buns and caraway cake. Claudia said, I found the most wonderful cookery book, the Old English Cookbook, full of original recipes. They're marvelous, though a bit lavish with cream and butter. I shall get fat if I'm not careful. At 17, she had weighed 8.5 stones. At 30, she had weighed 8.5 stones. Judging by the look of her, she weighed about that now. She recognized this as one of her blessings and was inclined to draw attention to the fact, either directly or indirectly. This did not endear her to her contemporaries, who at 40 tended to grow too plump or too lean. For the next hour, she regaled me with detailed accounts of where she had discovered every article of furniture, every ornament in the room, the state it had been in when discovered, and the price she had paid for it. She did this not boastfully, but gloatingly, as well she might. She'd acquired some marvelous bargains. And I never minded buying things earlier than the 18th century, she said earnestly. It stands to reason, doesn't it, that people came here bringing their treasures and heirlooms. And of course, I was sensible over mattresses and chairs and kitchen gadgets. After all, think of the help people had in those days. We need some compensation. Not that she was without help. She had wonderful help, a woman named Mrs. Hawk, who came from the village every day on a bicycle. She was actually coming back this evening to dish up the dinner and clear up afterwards. There again, I'm singularly lucky. Most people can't get any help in the evenings, or if they do, their women are clumsy and smash things. Mrs. Hawk was a parlor maid before she married, and she treats all my things as though they were her own. Len and Helen Crawley are coming to dinner. You'll like them, and they're very anxious to meet you. It'll be nice for me to introduce them to somebody. They've introduced me to some charming people. You know, a lot of people complain that as they grow older, they have fewer friends. Honestly, I have more. It was true, but it sounded smug. Presently, she began to move about, getting ready for their pre-dinner drinks. I always have Madeira nowadays. It is so in keeping. But of course, I have martinis and sherry as well. Whiskey, too. She kept her liquor in a cabinet, which she explained to me was Chinese Chippendale. And the olives and nuts were in sweetmeat dishes. By that time, I was a little edgy, a little less fond of the 18th century than I had been. Then she put her arm around me, and she was soft and warm and sweet-smelling. Now we'll go up. I'm simply longing to show you your room. At the foot of the stairs, we had a brief wrangle over who should carry the larger case. This time, I won. Claudia took the small one and went tipping ahead of me. The staircase, like the chimneys, considerably predated the house front. The steps were shallow and sloped sidely from left to right. The banister posts were intricately carved, the handrail very thick. I noticed all this as I mounted the first few stairs, and then all I was aware of was an increasing difficulty in moving upward. The distance between me and Claudia increased, and as it did, I moved more slowly, with more effort. The case dragged me backwards. I realized that I was badly out of condition. I had been living on a fifth floor and using the lift. I led a sedentary life, was unused to carrying heavy objects. Claudia dumped what she was carrying and sped down again. I told you you should have let me carry that. I'm a lot stronger than I look. She stood beside me on the wide stair and attempted to take the suitcase. Infuriated by the sidelong reference to her Dresden, China, please take care of me appearance, which is in such a strong contrast to my own, I wouldn't let go. So we went up the stairs with the case between us. And she was strong, I admit. There was a landing with some doors and an archway, which wasn't even Tudor. Late 13th or early 14th century, I've said, if asked. Beyond was a short passage and a door. Claudia threw it open, switched on a light, and said, "There," in a voice of triumph. It was quite the prettiest room I'd ever slept in. The paneled walls were painted a muted bluish green. The carpet matched exactly. There was a four-poster, smaller than a double, wider than a single bed, curtain covered and valanced, with glazed chintz, white scattered all over with moss rosebuds. The dressing table was Queen Anne chest, with a swing mirror and silver candlesticks made into electric lamps. "It's lovely," I said with genuine feeling. "You haven't seen half." She opened what looked like a section of paneling. "This was a powder closet. It's your bathroom. And this," she opened another section, "is a clothes closet. I had the rail put in. There were hooks. How did they manage? Just with hooks. All those voluminous clothes." Her voice changed. "Well, I'm glad you like it. As I told you, I had you in mind all the time." She gave me a fond smile and flitted away. I am inclined to view with caution any statement attributing human qualities to inanimate things, and I had just been surfeited with accounts of how this house felt towards Claudia, and how pieces of furniture had just stood there simply crying out to her to buy them. So I hesitated before admitting, even to myself, that the pretty rooms, appointed with me in mind, showed me an unwelcoming face. Instead, I thought that it was an exceptionally cold room. The green was the green of deep, cool water. The chintz had a glacial look. There was a radiator between the windows, and it occurred to me that Claudia had forgotten to turn it on. I went over to it and was surprised to find it scaldingly hot. It failed to warm the room, however, and it took a definite effort of will to remove my jacket and jersey and don a thin dress. Suddenly, I felt miserable. I was certain that Claudia, for all her sweetness of manner, didn't really want me. She wanted an appreciative eye, a listening ear. I thought of alternative arrangements I might have made for housing myself during my homeless interim. Then, in a burst of most unusual self-pity, I wondered whether anyone, anywhere, wanted me or ever had. Almost in a panic, I fled down to the drawing room and the fire, and once I was there, my mood changed. The Crawleys arrived and proved themselves excellent company. Two martinis dispelled my erstwhile woes. The dinner cooked, as Claudia was bound to inform us, according to the old English cookbook, was first class and beautifully served. It was not until 11:30, when the Crawleys announced reluctantly that they must go, that I remembered that I too must go to bed, to sleep in that frigid, unfriendly room. Claudia went to the door with her guests, and I began to empty ashtrays and plump up cushions. When she came back, she sat on a low stool, lighted a cigarette, and began to talk about the Crawleys and then about mutual friends in the past. Suddenly, from somewhere undefined, there came a dull, heavy thump. I gave a start, recovered myself, remembered Mrs. Hawk, and said, "Your woman stays late." "Oh, she's been gone ages," Claudia said. "I see what you mean. 10 o'clock is late for country people." She seemed not to have heard the thud, and I was on the point of mentioning it when I remembered reading an account of a house generally reckoned to be haunted. One of the manifestations was a dull thumping, heard by some people and not by others. And of course, as soon as I had entertained that cheerful thought, another thud sounded. Cold spots were physically significant, too. Claudia said, "Poor Annie, I am a brute keeping you up. You look quite pale. How about a nightcap and then straight into bed?" I accepted the nightcap with maybe overmuch avidity. This time going upstairs, though I carried nothing but a handbag, I had even more difficulty in mounting. I felt as though something soft yet unyielding was barring the way. I fought my way up, thinking how ridiculous the whole thing was, but made little progress until Claudia, coming behind me, put her hands on my waist and said, "You hardly know how to put one foot in front of the other. I shall bring you your breakfast in bed." I undressed quickly and climbed into bed, glad to find that it held an electric blanket, which had been switched on by Mrs. Hawk. The sheets were of fine linen, the pillows of down, the mattress springy, the covers almost weightless. A very comfortable bed, I thought, and composed myself for sleep. But sleep was far away. I lay there and suffered again, in retrospect, every slight, every snub, every injustice I had ever experienced in my life. When I reached the point where my mother preferred my brother to me, as what natural mother wouldn't, I got up angrily and swallowed one of the sleeping pills which I carry, just in case, and seldom need. After a time I did sleep, but I was soon awake again, practically certain that another of those thumps had awakened me. I lay waiting for another, which did not come. What did come was the memory of every ghastly, dreadful thing I'd ever heard of. Murder, atrocities of every kind, reeled out picturally before my mind's cringing eye. Then my joints began to ache, and I thought of the medieval torture thing known as little ease, a cage in which the prisoner could neither sit, nor stand, nor lie. Every joint became inflamed, and he lived for months in agony. I swallowed another pill and slept at last, to wake with a dry mouth and an aching head, to find Claudia by the bedside, gay and fresh as a daisy, holding a tray. She asked how I had slept, and I muttered, "Not very well." One often didn't one's first night in a strange bed, she said. Besides, she could see that I was overtired. She drew back the curtains and said that it was a lovely morning for the time of year, a slight mist with the sun just breaking through. How would I like to go for a drive to Lavenham, a famous old wool town with a wonderful church and an inn where we could lunch? She'd drive. I need to do nothing but sit back and enjoy the scenery. Before I went downstairs, I wrote a letter to a friend in High Wycombe, begging her to telephone me and demand that I go there immediately. I stamped the letter, but did not put it into my handbag. I intended to slip it into the pocket of my overcoat, whence I could withdraw it as soon as I sighted a post box. Why I should act so furtively, I don't know. Guests are allowed to write letters, but the ruse savored of ingratitude, and I did feel guilty. I went down. Claudia was ready. Mrs. Hawk was humming a hymn in the kitchen. I remembered my letter. I'd forgotten something I said. "I'll get the car out," Claudia said. "Isn't this a lovely morning for November? Aren't we lucky?" I turned to mount the stairs, struggled against whatever it was, made no headway, came out in goose pimples, and gave up. All that I saw that day, the charming, unspoiled countryside, the medieval town, the fine church, the low, dark bar, and the raftered dining room of the inn, I saw through a veil of gray muslin. I was astonished at myself, having always thought that I was a fairly down-to-earth person. I was frightened. Above all, I wanted to talk about the thing. If I could only say to somebody, "There's something on the stairs and in the guest room at Newell's that isn't quite canny," I should have felt better, just as people feel better as soon as they can describe the symptoms that they fear indicate some dread disease. But the last person to whom I could say that was Claudia, who had lived there so happily all alone, who had no suspicions. Over the lunch, which I could make only a pretense of eating, she said, "Now we'll go home by Long Melford. The church there is even better. And the way back, I can show you the house Len and Helen wanted me to have. They were terribly against Newell's. They thought it was much too run down and too isolated. They thought I'd be lonely." She gave a little laugh, and her face took an expression that I remember so well. The lucky girl with yet another present to display. "I dare say you'll think this is all whimsy-whamsy, but I am never alone in that house. I never have been. You see, I have a ghost." Following upon the thoughts I had been thinking, this was a shock. But something warned me that what she was talking about and what I was thinking about were two very different things. "Surely you don't mind, Annie. I wouldn't have mentioned it, not for worlds, if I thought you'd mind. I thought you'd be intrigued, and honestly, there's no need to mind. He's a most friendly ghost, my Captain Newell." I said, "Oh yes, you promised to tell me." She said, "I've always thought I was a teeny bit psychic. It was very odd. I went into that house when it had been empty and neglected for 20 years, all dust and dry rot and cobwebs, but it welcomed me. It really did. Then, when I came to look at the record of title, one name's Jeremiah Newell just leaped at me, and I realized that he'd loved the house. He'd lived there for 32 years, longer than anybody else, from 1799 to 1831. An old sailor home from the sea, with a sea chest perhaps, and a parrot. He loved that house, and he knows I love it. So he is my friend." I said, "How do you know? Have you seen or heard anything?" "Oh no, I just feel it. You can't ask for evidence about a thing like that. You just, well, you sort of tune in. I think he'd had an unhappy love affair and never married." Did you ever try to find out anything about him? She shook her head. I felt that would spoil it somehow. I think of him as tall and thick-set, sunburned and weather-beaten, and smoking a clay pipe. After all, it isn't what you know in such a case, it's what you feel. I persisted. And what do you feel exactly? I told you. A warm, friendly atmosphere, a sense of approval and of protection. Against what? Oh, whatever it is that women living alone dread, feeling lonely or burglars. I just feel that nothing could happen to me with Captain Newell around. That's why I named that home for him. It's his still. We share it. Mind you, Annie, I wouldn't say this to just anybody. I never mentioned it to Len and Helen. They were so sweet. They thought I ought to have a dog for company. So they gave me one of their boxer pups. She was a dear and I loved her. But she was absolutely hysterical. I said cautiously, can dogs be that? She was, or the canine equivalent. She had a thing about the stairs. She would never come up to them, no matter how I enticed her. And she'd stand in the hall with her hackles up and howl. You never heard anything so eerie. In the end, it got me down, and I had to ask Len to take her back. I know now why people in perilous situations make such bad, macabre jokes. I said, maybe she was aware of Captain Newell. Claudia laughed gaily. What an idea! I'm sure he loved dogs, and they loved him. Mind you, I don't deny that some dogs are credited with ESP, but if she'd had it, she'd have jumped and wagged her bit of tail. She was a victim of this overbreeding, poor dear. You know, Annie, you're more in need of a break than you realized. You've hardly eaten anything, and you're looking terribly pale. I think we'll leave Long Melford for another day and go straight home. Back at the house, I made the discovery that whatever it was that was opposed to my mounting the stairs allowed Claudia free passage, and that if I let her go first, she seemed to carry me along in her airway, so to speak. But my room still regarded me with a cold, inimical eye. My letter had gone from the dressing table, and when I mentioned it, Claudia said not to worry. She was sure Mrs. Hawk had taken it to post. I'm a bit careless about such things myself, and she's very conscientious. I asked Claudia if I might have a look at all her records pertaining to the house, and she produced them willingly. I couldn't bother with them, she said. So badly written, and all those were eases, and the aforementioned. The earliest was dated 1720, which in conjunction with the gutter spout had deluded Claudia that it was a record of transfer between William Martin and Thomas Pratt. Thomas Pratt had sold the property some 6 years later to Susanna Cobb, widow, whose occupancy was brief, only 7 months. In fact, the place had changed hands with a frequency that was remarkable. Jeremiah Newell, sea captain whose beautiful calligraphy would have distinguished him anywhere, was the only person who had stayed there any length of time. But Walter George Eisel, from whom Claudia Maybrook, widow, had purchased the property, ran Jeremiah pretty close. He'd owned it for 20 years. I remarked upon this, and Claudia said, oh, yes, but he never lived here. He lived up at the park, and he bought it for his agent. Now, that is a very sad story, and it accounts for the house standing empty so long. Not, of course, that I can be sorry, because in my heart, I must confess that I'm glad the house waited for me. What happened? Well, Mrs. Agent was going to have a baby, so they needed more room. So Mr. Eisel bought this place, and Mrs. Agent came over to measure for curtains or something. You know how our generation was, take no notice. Don't let nature dictate, carry on regardless. She probably shouldn't have been exerting herself at all. She came here alone and had a fall. It brought on a frightful miscarriage, and she died. So then the house just stood and rotted, because the agent naturally didn't need any more room and wouldn't have wanted to live here anyway. quite understandable. Did she fall on the stairs? Claudia gave me a sharp look. As a matter of fact, yes. How did you guess? You know, it's funny. I've always thought that if you came here, you'd sense, you know, she waved a pretty hand, all the stored up history. Young Mrs. Isel told me about the tragedy at a cocktail party. I think she was trying to explain why the house was in such a state. Nobody seemed to realize that I loved saving it. That night was worse than the one before. Determined to have no nonsense, firmly expecting that on the morrow I should be safe in High Wycombe, I took 2 pills and fell asleep almost immediately. I woke to find myself rigid with cold, though the bedclothes were undisturbed. I switched on the blanket and it grew warm. So did such parts of my body as were in contact with it. The rest of me stayed cold. Perhaps it was that made me begin to think about my death, the form it would take, where, when. It was supremely idiotic. I knew that everybody must die, that every birth certificate was a death warrant. So far as I knew, I was in perfect health. I was 46 years old, and women are long-lived creatures. There was plenty of time to prepare for death, but I thought about dying, about the possibility of being buried alive. My heart fluttered. My breathing became difficult. I had horrible cramps. I tried to read, but the print danced. I was forced to consider my most urgent fear, the fear of going blind. There I capitulated. I got out of bed, put on my slippers and dressing gown, snatched up my book, and retreated. As I went through the arch to the landing, I heard one of the thuds. In the drawing room, a last log moldered dimly. I turned it over and added some more fuel. I poured myself a drink, smoked a cigarette, read for a little, felt naturally sleepy, arranged myself on the sofa, and slept. Claudia woke me, anxious, clucking, inquisitive. I told her that I suffered from insomnia, that I had come down for a drink, felt sleepy suddenly, and snatched the chance of a snooze. She has very clear blue eyes, and then in them I could see insomniac change to dipsomniac, as plainly as the signs change at Piccadilly Circus. But she said she'd always thought that the life I lead must be a terrible strain, and now she knew. What I needed was rest and quiet and looking after. All these she was ready to provide, starting now with breakfast. I imagined my letter arriving at High Wycombe and managed breakfast quite well. It was another mild, windless, silver-gilt day, and presently Claudia suggested that we should drive out to Clare Priory. A fascinating place, she said, built in 1248, dissolved in 1538, used as a private home until 1953, when the Augustinian friars had bought it back and made it into a religious house again. I was just about to concoct some excuse for staying in the house for an hour when Mrs. Hawk arrived. Claudia asked about my letter, and the woman said she hadn't seen it. Had she seen it, she would certainly have posted it. Claudia said that I must have put it in my bag after all, and I pretended to agree. There would be no reprieve from High Wycombe, I thought, with an inward tremor, so I might as well go to Clare. It is there for all to see, and the friars welcome visitors, so there is no need to describe it. Not that I could. I was too much concerned by my own situation to give attention to anything. Perhaps this is why I was stupid enough when a sudden turn brought us to the foot of a staircase to move towards it. The young friar who was showing us around stepped forward very quickly and lifted his arm, barring my way. He smiled. No, I am sorry, ladies are not allowed. He indicated a notice in Latin on the wall. Claudia said brightly, of course, dormitories. Then she looked at me, exclaimed, oh, Annie, we've tired you out again. You look so pale. Are you all right? I couldn't speak. It would be wrong to say that the truth had flashed upon me, for in cases like this, who can describe what is this truth? I only know that the arm outthrust to bar my way here was so directly related with what I felt on the staircase at Newell's that I was overcome by an appalling understanding. I dare say I had turned pale. They took me back into the parlor with its massive carved beams, set me in a chair, and fussed round. At least Claudia fussed. The friar fetched a glass of ice-cold water, which I sipped, wishing it had something hot and strong. As soon as I could speak, I said, "I'm all right now. Sorry to be such a nuisance." Then I asked what seemed to me to be a vital question. "Did this priory have subsidiary houses in the vicinity?" The question, certainly the most intelligent one he had heard from me that morning, seemed to please the friar. "Indeed, yes, several. They were minor establishments for rest or for correction." He smiled just as noticeably abstentious people smile when they talk about last night's binge. "There are bad friars sometimes, you know." Then grave again, he added, "Often the name remains, Friar's Place, Priory Farm, and so on." "My house could have been one of them," Claudia said, all excitement. "It was called Priory Farm at one time." She had read her record of title more closely than she had admitted. "But when I bought it, it was called Pratt's, just Pratt's. Such a snatchy sounding word, so I changed it again." "Back to the original?" the friar asked. "I'm afraid not. I named my house for a friend, a very dear old friend." She threw me a knowing look. I felt a little sick, thinking herself psychic and all the time so oblivious, so immune. "Wire a chest of drawers to a television serial," I thought, "and what do you get?" I thought of Susanna Cobb, who had fled after 7 months, and of the agent's wife, doubly unwelcome because of her pregnancy. I thought of me. All my thoughts led to the same decision. I did not intend to spend another night in that house. I had an excuse ready. As soon as Claudia and I were alone together, I should tell her that my tired spells, my pallor, were the result of renewed trouble with my slip disc. I should say that it was absolutely essential that I get to London while I could still drive. I must see my osteopath. About leaving her alone, I had no compunction. She lived in the house for 2 years and felt nothing of its real atmosphere. She could live there to her life's end and babble about her friendly ghost. There leaped into my mind the memory of something from school days. Gresham's Law, which says that at any time, in any place, bad currency will oust the good. And in Captain Jeremiah Newell, his clay pipe, his parrot, and his sea chest, Claudia had psychic currency enough and to spare. "And now, if you're feeling better," the friar said, "I would like to show you our chapel. We are particularly proud of the restoration work in our chapel." Mindful of the plan I proposed, I murmured that I wouldn't walk any more. I'd sit here and wait. "Poor Annie, what a shame. Would you like to go straight home?" "No, no. You see the chapel and anything else you want to. I am all right here." "I would like just a peep, if you're sure." She went off, tripping and chirping. The friar opened a door, and I saw an enclosure with flower beds and trees and gray paving. After a minute or two, I heard a distant cry, which could have been one of exaggerated admiration from Claudia, but which sounded rather more like one of pain. It was the latter, I realized, when the door opened again and revealed Claudia, leaning heavily upon the arm of the friar, who looked very much concerned. She was favoring her left ankle, which was already swelling. The pupils in her blue eyes were wide. Where her face was unrouged, it looked chalky. She was positively being very brave. "Don't say it," she said with a ghastly attempt at sprightliness. "These ridiculous heels, I know, I know." Then she swayed, and we had to put her in the chair and force her head down. Fortunately, I had not drunk all the water. She soon recovered and was full of apologies to the friar and to me. "Darling, I am so sorry. I'm afraid you'll have to drive home." "If I may suggest, to the hospital," the friar said. "It is a severe wrench. You may have broken a bone. It would be advisable to have an x-ray." Looking down at the bulge above the edge of Claudia's high-heeled, low-cut court shoe. I could but agree. By the time the x-ray had been taken and had revealed that no bones were broken, and we had found our way to casualty and Claudia's ankle had been firmly wrapped, and we made a donation to the Friends of the Hospital, and she had hobbled back to the car, and I had driven home, the afternoon light was failing. Afternoons are short in November. "I really am the most lucky girl," Claudia said, "to have this happen while you are with me. It'll be dull for you, darling, for a day or two, but we'll make up for it after." My own luck didn't bear thinking about. At least another couple of nights here. Even had my slip disc been genuine, I couldn't have left her in this extremity. I made one futile attempt at self-protection. I suggested the stairs would be too much for her and that she should stay on the drawing room sofa. I reckoned rather wildly that I would force myself upstairs once, now before it was fully dark, and throw down unbreakable things, carry down the rest, all that we could possibly need for the night. Then I could say that I didn't like to leave her and sleep in a chair or on the hearth rug. But no, oh no, Claudia would have none of that. She was being brave. She could get upstairs all right. I mustn't worry. She'd go to bed, and if I would be kind enough, I could bring her a tray. The meal was all ready. Mrs. Hawk had seen to it. All I had to do was put a few things on a tray, then I could read or write or watch television. She was so sorry to be such a nuisance. We went upstairs easily enough, side by side, one step at a time, Claudia holding on to me with her left hand and leaning on the banister rail with the other. In her bedroom, I switched on her blanket and folded back the covers and waited while she hopped and leaned on the piece of furniture, donned an extraordinarily seductive nightdress, and did a lot of complicated things to her face and hair. Finally installed in bed and looking like herself again, a full-blown, sweetly scented pink rose, she said triumphantly, "There, darling, I'm all right now. And you know, I've just remembered you've had no lunch. I am so sorry. Just slap a snack on a tray for me and then have a lovely long evening to yourself." I had a strong desire to break down and cry, to say that I wanted to stay here in this warm, rosy-lighted room, the safe company of the blind, deaf, lucky woman whose only ghost was the trite, conventional product of her own imagination. But if I did that, I should have to say why. I went down. The kitchen was reassuring. The refrigerator purred like a contented cat. The soup was in a saucepan needing only to be heated. The bowls were ready. I took a large tray and tried to concentrate upon gathering together everything two people could need for a simple meal. But my mind was distracted. Part of it remembered the friar's outthrust arm, the Latin words on the walls, the little quip about bad friars. Another part was wondering how long Claudia would be incapacitated. How many other evenings should I be in this situation? While the soup heated, I looked to the fastenings of the door. No cheerful task, since I was locking myself in with what I dreaded. All the time I was moving nearer to the moment when I must face, alone, what waited for me on the stairs. I poured the soup, put the lids on the bowls, lifted the tray, and went into the hall. I was quivering a little and cringing already. Outside the drawing room door, I paused. A drink might help. Also, Claudia might be expecting some of her precious Madeira. "Excuses," my mind shouted at me. "You're just putting off the bad minute." I set the tray on a low table and went to the cabinet. There I slopped a generous measure of gin into a glass, added a drop of vermouth and gulped it down, tasting nothing. It ran searingly into an empty stomach and seemed to take fire there. Warmed and heartened, and with steadier hands I poured a glass of Madeira and another, more normally proportioned, martini, and found room for two glasses on the tray. As I moved towards the door, I heard one of those dull thuds. Familiar now with the layout of the house, I knew where it came from. my own room, immediately overhead. It sounded like a warning. I'm waiting. Unnerved by this, but pop valiant, I advanced towards the stairs. At the fourth step, I met opposition so strong that I recoiled and almost fell backwards. I just managed to retain my balance and to stand there teetering. I thought of Claudia, waiting in her pink room, and knew that with her I should be safe. Sanctuary, I must reach it, but I might as well have tried to walk through a wall. I was so much aware of personal animosity, a direct threat, that I addressed an appeal to whatever it was. I understand, I said in my mind, you were one of those who found their vows of chastity hard to keep. Some woman was a temptation to you, so you hate us all. But I'm harmless, I assure you. Then I realized what I was doing and thought, I'm going mad. I was shaking so violently that all the things on the tray jangled together. Soup, Madeira, martini, slopped onto the tray and spilled over, tepid, on my icy hands. I thought, I'll call Claudia. She, for some reason, is immune. She'll come. I called. I screamed her name, but it was like it is sometimes in a nightmare. There was no sound. In a nightmare, at that point, one wakes, but I was awake, still senselessly throwing myself against that invisible barrier. Then, and it was horrible, I thought that I could smell my opponent. A blend of boiled mutton, human sweat, and stale incense. I began to pray, God help me. Please, God help me. I started on the Lord's Prayer, one splinter of my shattered mind registering surprise at how glibly the words came. I reached and deliver us from evil, and stuck there like a gramophone needle. Deliver us from evil, from evil, from evil, 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 but I was not delivered. Incoherent, on the verge of madness, I remembered Captain Newell and the immunity with which Claudia passed up these stairs. You may not like me very much, I cried in my mind, but I'm trying to take this to your friend. Almost instantly, and crazy as this may sound, it is true. The unpleasant mutton sweat and incense odor was replaced by the smell of a very strong tobacco, and the pressure against me withdrew so suddenly that I, leaning against it, fell forward. If I had had a free hand with which to clutch at the banister, I could have saved myself, even then. As it was, I fell, spiraling down into darkness, to the accompaniment of the noise that a laden tray makes when it falls downstairs. The next thing I knew was a feeling of warmth and comfort, a sensation of being cherished that I had not known since childhood. I lay and savored this for a while. Then I looked about me and realized that I was in Claudia's room in her bed. The rose-shaded lamp made an island of light, and her sweet floral scent enveloped me. Safe, I thought, saved. I lay and enjoyed that feeling, which is one that most people in civilized countries seldom know. Presently, I was aware of voices. Claudia's in a deep male one with a bird to it. She said, no harm done. I just hopped. He said, but it couldn't have happened at a more unfortunate time. Would you know, is it a frequent occurrence? She said, I couldn't say, you see, it's some years. But I think I should have heard. Anyway, one mustn't judge, must one? I mean, people like her live on their nerves, and it is recognized now that alcohol does relieve tension. And she hasn't had a happy life, poor girl. Talking about me? Well, Mrs. Gaywood, I can assure you there is no injury. I doubt if she'll develop bruises. They fall lightly. And there's nothing for you to worry about. Let her lie and sleep it off. They were talking about me, and in what terms? Not that it was surprising, with that neat gin I'd gulped, and the Madeira martini from the tray. I must reek like a distillery, I thought, but still. I roused myself and said about the most damning thing I could in the circumstances. I'm not drunk, I said in a loud, belligerent voice. Claudia limped towards the bed. She wore negligee that matched the nightdress. Darling, nobody even thought that you were. He did. Oh, yes, he did. I heard him. I lifted myself and looked towards the dark bulk with a stern, unmistakably Scottish, unmistakably doctory face. This is Dr. McGraw, Claudia said. He helped me carry you up. You're in my bed because that was warm and yours wasn't. You fell, Annie. It's all my fault, making you hump that gray, heavy tray. But you aren't hurt, only shaken a bit and run down. And I'm going to take the greatest care of you. You're sweet, I said. That's what you are, sweet. Everybody loves you, and no wonder. To my profound astonishment, I found that I was crying. You don't know what it's like for the rest of us, I gulped. Even at school, you were Miss Fraser's pet. You never lost a friend. You never gained a pound. You've lived here for 2 years and nothing touched you. I've been here 2 days and look at me. I can't think why we don't hate you. You're so lucky. If you went into hell, you'd come out with a bunch of snowdrops. Claudia said helplessly, Oh, Annie. Dr. McGraw said, A sedative would be the thing, but I don't like mixing with all that alcohol. What do you mean, all that alcohol? One miserable drink? Taken as medicine. That's what it was. I sobbed harder. I've had a terrible experience, but nobody's sorry for me. Some remaining crumb of sense in my mind warned me not to go on about my experience. It also took notice of the threat implicit in Claudia's promise to look after me. Oh God, I thought. She'll try to make me stay in bed in that room, through the archway. I made an effort to control myself, to be crafty again. A terrible experience, I repeated. I happen to suffer from a slipped disc which causes me exquisite agony. I faint with pain, frequently. As a matter of fact, if Mrs. Gaywood hadn't sprained her ankle, I intended to go to London this very afternoon and put myself in the hands of my osteopath. Dr. McGraw stepped forward a little and regarded me more coldly than a doctor should regard even a dipsomaniac. And after all, he must have seen real drunks in his life, and said, If you have faith in your osteopath, I should advise you to consult him without delay. For one thing, Mrs. Gaywood is in no condition to look after you just now. Oh, thank you, I said. Thank you for the passport. They both looked at me, blankly. Then Dr. McCraw put his hand on Claudia's sleeve and drew her away. I heard him say, The effects take time to wear off. I thought, how true. I doubted if they ever would completely, or that I should ever be quite the same again.